Our World is produced by headscape.co.uk. It is brought to you by Shopify, an e-commerce solution made by designers for designers. For more information, visit shopify.com/Boagworld. On this week's show, the Northerners are joined by the Headscape duo, Craig and Dave. We talk about why you should care about .NET MVC and answer your questions about managing your code and friendly URLs.
Hi Paul, how are you doing?
Hi Paul, how are you?
Hello Paul.
Hi Paul.
Hi Paul and Marcus.
Hello and welcome to the first ever BoagWorld.com podcast.
Boag World.
Hello and welcome to the 100th episode of BoagWorld.com.
Hello and welcome to the 180th episode of BoagWorld.com, the podcast for all those designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. And today we've got a very special show, because not only have you got myself, Ryan Taylor and Paul Stanton.
Hello. So
we've also got the Headscape lads, Dave and Craig. Hello guys.
Hello.
Oh, you sound so enthused.
Wow.
with a very convoluted setup, because I'm now in a studio on my own because Paul melts in the rain.
I don't melt in the rain, right? It's absolutely bouncing it down in Leeds at the moment, and it was quite nice this morning. So I've just got a t-shirt and no jacket, no brolly, and it's a 10-minute walk to where you are. So I thought, sack that, you can ring me.
Okay, and then we're ringing through to Southampton or Hampstead. Is that where you guys?
No,
are?
Rural Hampshire, really.
Hampshire.
We've got our own special setup here with a. Two VoIP phone, speakers, mics, all sorts. It's going all over the place. Not even sure how it works, to be honest.
Well, it took you long enough to get it going.
That's true.
Yeah. We will be posting pictures of the setup in all our respective locations, just for a laugh. You know,
it wouldn't be a technical version of the podcast for that one, really, would it?
Well, no. You know, but this is probably the most technical podcast we've recorded, I have to say.
It's quite impressive.
So we've got a real north-south divide going on at the moment, haven't we?
We have.
And not only have we got two southerners on the line, they're also we've got a PHP and .NET war going on.
Ooh. Is it really a war? Are we bothered?
I don't know. We can scrap about it if you want.
I'm not going to go down there, though, scrap with them about it.
Nah, we'll just win by default.
So Paul's actually on holiday this week, isn't he, again?
Again?
No, he's back at work. He's just feeling a bit lazy, I think, to be honest.
I wondered that today when we were on it. I got an email saying he's back to work today. Was it an email? Twitter? I don't know, something.
Yeah, he's at work.
Oh, I don't know. You know, we've done so many shows now, Stanton, me and you. I keep a list of the shows I've been involved with on my site, you know, because once upon a time it was just a few shows, you know, and I thought, you know, people visiting my site will click through, might be interested in what ones I've hosted and stuff like that. And now if you look at the numbers, it's like every bloody week, give or take a couple of numbers. So I'm thinking about taking it off, because it just looks like, you know, I host Boag World, and occasionally Paul Boag and Marcus Lillington do it as well.
You just change it around. I've done all the shows apart from.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to have a development week this week, because it gets requested quite a lot, so we thought we'd get the Headscape lads on, because they know what they're talking about, and you as well, Stanton. I have to admit that I'm probably going to be the Marcus Lillington of this show, because I have no idea what you guys are talking about. So I'll just listen and nod.
Nah, you've done some development.
Yeah. It's been a long time.
Are you guys back or front, or what do you do? What do you do?
Well, I generally class myself as a front-end developer, although invariably I'm required to do back-end stuff, but I realise that things like, you know, OOP and MVC and all that kind of...
More acronyms.
Often not go, yeah, not the acronyms. I know what the acronyms stand for, but more often than not, they go over my head, unfortunately.
That's half the battle, just knowing what the acronyms stand for. You can put that on your CV.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You don't even need to know. You can just put a list on your CV of all the acronyms you can think of.
You can follow Wikipedia. Wikipedia is great for finding acronyms, and just copy a bunch out, and no one will bother to question you.
Yeah. It's good. Good in client meetings, you know. The more I found a word that I can't say.
Which word is that?
What's that word that Paul can't say?
I've forgotten.
Oh, we're taking piss out of him on Udrath Podcast when we first met him.
Innovative.
Innovative, yeah, yeah. You cannot say innovative.
Yeah. It is a tricky one.
Not at all.
It's not at all.
Just a word.
Yeah.
What about innovative acronyms?
Innovative acronyms. So, so we're rambling on. So this is going to be
like a classic Paul and Ryan podcast.
Oh yeah, but people love that. People love it. Really? That's what they say. You know, I mean, we're getting so much fan mail through now. You know.
Have you done a poll yet comparing you to Paul and Marcus's?
We've had people saying, you know, well, they want Paul to just go on holiday permanently just so we can take over the show.
I think one of the favourite bits of feedback I got recently, someone said it on Twitter to Paul. They said that Ryan and Stanton are the Frasier to Paul and Marcus's Cheers. Which I didn't know whether was that a compliment or a put down. I can't quite figure that out. But
and I was wondering which one of us is Frasier and which one of us is Niles.
I think you'd have to be Niles.
Why is that then?
Just cause I don't want to be.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. So,
I think we've got to pimp out at Paul and Marcus's South by Southwest panels, haven't we?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. They've got two panels. I can't remember the links, but we'll include them in the show notes.
Yeah, I'll just check Paul's Twitter stream. I think he's pimping them out every other tweet at the moment.
Yeah, because they have to go.
Do you remember what they are?
Some variation on getting clients to say yes, isn't it? That's his usual favourite.
Yeah.
Okay. Harsh words.
And in the other,
it's a great talk.
Isn't the other one a live Borg World?
Yeah, the live Borg World was really good last year, actually. It had Joe Stump, Daniel Becker, Jeremy Keith and Andy Budd on the panel, so it was quite a good Q&A, actually.
Did you guys go last year?
Yeah, we were sitting front row. Okay. Exciting, eh?
And you're off again this year, aren't you?
Yeah, you guys could come down, meet us there.
Yeah, that's just not going to happen.
When is it? When is the actual South By?
It's middle of March, I think.
It's about March 12th, something like that.
I wonder.
If you can afford it, I mean, obviously a lot of people can't either afford it or get time off or time away from family and stuff, but if you can, it's really definitely an excellent thing to go to. I wouldn't in any way...
The sheer number of talks and the level of quality is just fantastic.
Yeah, it's one I do really want to go to. I won't be able to make next year, but fingers crossed for the year after.
We've been saying that for about 3 years though, Paul, haven't we?
Yeah. Yeah, but we are going to deconstruct. Is that next week or the week after?
That's next week.
Next week, what?
Next Friday, I think.
Oh, no, next Thursday for the party.
Yeah, I think we're all going, aren't we? We're doing some sort of, I don't know, get-together-y thing.
Yeah, have you guys figured out if you're going down on Thursday or Friday yet?
I kind of want to go Thursday now that other people are going Thursday, but I think we're going Friday. I don't really know. This is really interesting for listeners, I think, that we're deciding on our plans. Oh, what time are you going to be there? Yeah, I'll meet you here. That'd be good.
No, well, if anyone's listening who's going, we're all going to be there, so if you do see us, do come say hi.
Yeah, no, I think Paul said there's some sort of Borg World thing.
Yes, Friday lunchtime there's a bunch of meetups going on, and there will be a Borg World meetup if you want to meet Paul and the gang.
Yep, as in us lot, basically.
Yeah, I think last year at the lunchtime of the conference, I was so hungover still from the night before that I just went and found a quiet corner and ate, like, sausages and mash somewhere. Didn't really want to socialise.
Do you know what I've realised? Having four people on the show means we're going to talk and ramble twice as long.
Ah, well.
Than just having two of us. Because we've not even started the news yet and we're already about 8 minutes into recording.
I think we're on schedule for a 2-hour Borg World special.
That'd be good.
People will fall asleep. All the designers that normally listen will just fall asleep, you know, because it's like, oh, it's development, and these guys are obviously really boring.
You can always edit it really crazily, just mid-sentence. Just join us together, so like, I'll start saying something, then Paul can finish.
I'll just do some kind of rap version podcast.
If you've got like a little deck there of random stuff.
Yeah, I'm kind of because I didn't go down to Ryan's studio. I'm in the boss's office at the moment because there's still people working. So, and I've found a Mr. T in your pocket keyring on my boss's desk.
Don't make me mad.
It's like the best thing in the world.
I think we should. I think we should move on to the news, don't you?
Go on, then.
All right.
Go for it.
Right, so the first article is a post by Smashing Magazine, which tries to persuade you into doing something different every once in a while. It's called Extending Your Development Skills with Creative Tech Projects, and this points out that even if you're a web developer, your next project doesn't have to be a website. you can learn a lot by doing something outside your normal comfort zone, and there's some great examples here of different things you could play with, such as writing your own desktop application using Adobe Air or something like that, extending Firefox, creating interfaces for your favourite gadget, such as an iPhone or a Nintendo Wii, playing with hardware such as the Wiimote, Arduino kits or Lego Mindstorms. One of the things I love about working in this industry is the sheer amount of cool stuff that's available for us to play with. Admittedly, it can often be hard to find the time or even justify the time playing with cool stuff when client work's stacking up and there's bills to be paid. But who knows, you might find that people out there would pay good money to build things using the skills you acquire. And silence from my panel.
That's so, excellent advice, really. You know, even if you discover that you're crap at everything else and websites is all you've got to go with, then it's worth finding that out, I guess.
Yeah, what do you guys do? I mean, I know you're quite hardcore developers most of the time. Do you try and play with cool stuff, new stuff?
Someone just fallen over.
No, someone came into the room. Don't worry about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, we made that Adobe Air application back in Christmas time, which we'll keep going on about. But
did people know that we made that on Christmas Eve, or is that?
No, we keep that one.
No, no.
You made it on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, okay, I was all set. I brought in Guitar Hero. I brought in a whole bunch of games for the Wii, and it was only me and Dave in. We ended up programming instead of actually playing any games.
It was like the last day of school where you get to take your toys.
There's nothing wrong with Guitar Hero.
Yeah, but what were you doing in the office on Christmas Eve?
Working.
Why?
It was just the two of us.
Well, do you know what though, Paul? Not everybody's like you.
Yeah, I think I'm
so
spoiled.
Much time. You spoil at the university.
See, we get 2 weeks off around Christmas. It's awesome.
Well, you know, half the time you're not there anyway. Double bank holidays and the lot.
I only get, I think, when you count public holidays, like bank holidays and bank holiday Tuesdays, which is a marvellous invention, I think about between 30 and 40 days.
Yeah.
What, that you work?
unlike the rest of us that might be lucky if we get 25.
See, I don't have any violin sounds. You just got set with Mr. T.
Don't give me no thanks, sucker!
Anyway, back to the news article then.
Yeah, so you've played with the .NET MVC stuff, but that's kind of part of.
Yeah, well, I started playing with that with them just because it was new and cool and fun, and then a couple of projects came up where it actually turned out to be perfect. So sort of pushed for it, and it turns out the learning was definitely valuable, and it's great just trying something new and something cutting edge, something that everyone's talking about, and it's just more interesting.
I think the thing as well is it takes you out of your day-to-day stuff. So, I mean, if you're working on very text page content driven sites a lot, maybe from a CMS, then you're going to get kind of bored. And if you can take a bit of time aside and do something either with Air or with Firefox, then it just brings that enthusiasm level back up, I think. So,
yeah. Do you find it hard to convince Paul and the guys there to let you play with things? Do you have to give
Paul
a business
dead
case?
Easy to convince. Paul is not the problem.
Okay.
Right, so...
What's that Firefox thing? You know, it says extend Firefox. There's that thing that made it easier.
Jetpack.
Jetpack,
yeah. I had a play with that the other day.
Oh, yeah?
For
what were you doing?
10 minutes. I was helping a mate out who was doing the oddest of things. He was just replacing words in the body content. But, yeah, anyway, I probably shouldn't have brought that up. But it is really easy. Essentially, you can you just get a text area and you can put in any JavaScript and run it, and it will. You can put, for example, a button in the taskbar that will bring up something else, like hover a div over your content, and then just run with jQuery, so you can do whatever you like. It was really easy to do.
Oh, cool.
I think you got to look for those moments when you think, "Oh, why didn't someone? I could really do with something that does this. Why didn't someone built it?" And it's just taking that opportunity and says, "Right, I'll learn how to do it and I'll build it myself."
Mm. And often it becomes really popular then, because everybody else wants to do the same thing.
Yeah.
So.
Well, moving onwards, mm-hmm. The next article is called 5 Advanced Photoshop Techniques for Web Designers. So I know this is a top 5 post, but it's quite a good one, so I thought I'd tell you about it. And this is one on the Think Vitamin blog, which gives you a decent rundown of 5 popular visual effects in modern web design and tells you how to replicate them. There's tons of screenshots and explanations on how to make things like awesome buttons, navigation menus, inset typography, faded shadows, and depth. It's a good post to bookmark for those times when you have a spare few minutes to mess about in Photoshop and try new things, or if you've seen an effect that you like that you'd maybe want to learn how to use.
I'm just ringing this up because I've not had a chance to look at this, but
yeah, it's quite a good one. I noticed on Twitter, I think Andy Clark was a bit upset because a couple of the screenshots are from his For a Beautiful website, and that's like the insect typography, and there was no credit or attribution there, and he got a bit annoyed. And the funny thing was that it was really tongue in cheek, but he took the Think Vitamin logo at the top of the blog post and changed it to Comic Sans just to say, this is how annoyed I am. It was quite amusing.
Cool. Yeah, looks like a good tutorial.
Okay, yeah. We shall move swiftly onwards. And the last article, I thought I'd keep it short and sweet today, seeing as there's four of us, but this is a blog by dig.com on their move to Git, which is a source control bit of jiggery-pokery. This is the first of a two-part article detailing how the developers at Dig are making the move from Subversion to Git. I realise that source control doesn't get discussed much on this show, but it's something that every designer and developer should be using if they're not already. And I'm not wanting to start a Subversion versus Git argument here, but I'm very interested in seeing how big established teams work in regards to source control. And this is quite a candid account from Dig team about the scaling issues they've experienced as their team expanded and how Subversion struggled under load at times. They're starting to use Git to solve some of these problems, highlighting both the good and bad points of the new system. So everyone will have their own source control preference, but if you're part of a large team and have source control issues, which probably don't we all, then give this a read. Don't know if you guys have had a chance to read this one.
No, I think you emailed me the show notes 5 minutes before we started, so it's a bit tricky.
What do you use at Headscape for source control?
We use it's kind of a small, unheard of little program called Source Anywhere, which we quite like because it integrates quite nicely with Visual Studio, which a lot of things do anyway. But it's primarily sort of GUI-based, which gets on really well with our designers, who, for some reason, they just don't get on with the command line. How many times you give them cheat sheets, whatever, they just don't like it and end up just not using it. So it's a nice GUI program where you can sort of just click on files, check them out, check them in, put in comments. And it's quite handy because it's database driven as well, so you don't end up with lots of nested folders that people accidentally push onto live servers. It's all sort of neat and tidy and leaves your file system where it should be.
Okay, that's quite nice.
So of course you've got a single point of failure there with your database, but I think we use that as more like a legacy thing from previous projects rather than change. Of course the problem you have with a source control system is as soon as you've got it with a lot of history going back some number of years, you've got to have the fun of an import-export process to get it anywhere else, which I guess puts a lot of people off. So it'd be interesting to read that blog post and see how Dick handled that, because that would be, I think, the fear, not necessarily within the people doing it, like the tech team doing it, but within the organisation as a whole, of suddenly saying, yeah, we're going to shift essentially our entire intellectual capital from one place to another. It'll be fine, don't worry about it.
And then there's the fear factor of project managers, and then there's this sort of idea that you might lose everything in between, and it's just time where you're not actually making any money. But it does look quite interesting.
Going back to the GUI thing that Dave mentioned, I just want to say, I think people love being able to do stuff on the command line a bit too much. I think there seems to be this kind of power thing of, yeah, look at me, I can do it on the command line, and then an anti-GUI thing. And it's just like, why? If it's easier, then why not use a GUI? Yeah. Why sort of suggest that you I don't know, maybe that's just me being annoyed at people. But,
I've met a few
people. If the GUI does the job, then I think it's so much more powerful and easier to use, so why not use that?
Yeah.
The tricky thing you get with .NET stuff, obviously, I guess most people know that Headscape are a .NET house, so we're using Visual Studio a lot, is that a lot of .NET developers start off using Visual Source Safe, which is, again, a database. I think, Paul, you've been using this recently.
Yeah.
Again, that's a database-driven one, and it does have this plug into Visual Studio, so people get very happy with having a plug-in where the files have a lock and bolt, and you've got it or you haven't got it. So if you try and give them something like Git, where it just looks like you've got files, and then you have to separately commit and make changes, I think it scares people a lot.
Yeah, it was interesting reading the Dig article, because the team I work in, we're kind of the early stages of what they're going through now. We've got a couple of .NET developers who are pretty entrenched in SourceSafe simply for the legacy stuff like you mentioned. And one of their main arguments was that they wanted the source control to be integrated into Visual Studio. And it's at the point now where all our design side are using Git and the .NET side are using SourceSafe. And I spoke to you guys earlier in, I think, last week, asking what you used. And Craig, you mentioned to me Git Extensions, which is a plugin for Visual Studio. So at the moment, I'm using both. I'm using SourceSafe to pass back and forth between the developers, and Git to pass back and forth between the designers. So it's a bit complicated, but it seems to be working. And yeah. I think I'm using it to establish to then go to the .NET developers and say, look, this is working, it's fine, and then maybe we'll gradually move everything onto Git after a while.
It'd be interesting to know whether they have kind of what's the word, psychological issues, I guess, of going away from a paradigm of source anywhere where it's source safe, where it's check out, check in, and the files are locked to the individual user. Because when we were talking about that Git extension, it was interesting because the reason was that people wanted the plugin. But when you have the plugin, all it really is a launcher for the Git GUI. The plugins that you get for Microsoft-based stuff like SourceSafe actually give you this whole checkout, check-in, lock symbol thing, which is probably what they actually like, that kind of weird security, rather than just the fact that it's in the IDE. And so if you give them the Git extension one, although they've got a plugin, it's actually still a different paradigm anyway that they've still got used to. So it's probably that's going to cause you the problem rather than the extension or lack of.
Yeah, I think it's mentioned in the Dig blog as well that it's a complete different system that they're still trying to get their head around. But they point out a return on investment thing because they're branching, merging, and checking, and especially pushing to a live server. They've cut that down from like 30 minutes to like 30 seconds simply because of the benefits of Git. And then they do say the downsides are that there's not enough polished tools. And yeah, you have to go into the command line every so often if you need to do something pretty funky. But I don't know.
But its power really is in the ability to fork and branch stuff, isn't it? I mean, that's something where I think that what we use Source anyway, it kind of does it, but it's just not very good at it, and we generally don't do it because it's just annoying. Whereas something like Git would really encourage us to be branching stuff more often and think, well, what if we change this? And then you sort of decide it doesn't work, or it does work, and you merge it back in, and it seems like a more sensible way of working.
The key thing, I guess, with Git as well is the distributed nature of it. So you've actually got history on every client machine, haven't you? Isn't that?
Yeah, that's right. We're building a .NET application at the moment, and I'm doing like some of the front end build. And the .NET guys have got the same kind of code base on their machines because they're using SourceSafe. But there's two, me and another designer working on it, and we've got separate versions, effectively separate branches that we're working on separate things. And we can quite easily pass things back and forth and go off in completely different directions to each other, not step on each other's toes, and the benefit is, especially if you're working in a remote team, because it's distributed, you don't have to be connected to a central server like you do with a Subversion. You've got a full copy of the code base, you can commit as much as you want locally, and then when you do have network connectivity, push everything back up to the any remote repository that you do have, or just push back and forth. I know this is starting to get a really techie conversation.
This is a development podcast, though, for this week only.
That's fine.
Is it really juvenile of me to giggle when I hear Git?
Probably.
I can't help it. And a version control is something I've sat down a couple of times and tried to get it all set up and everything and get myself using it, and invariably I'm more often than not working on my own. And I really just need a developer person to come along, take me by the hand, show me how it works, set it up for me, and say, this is what you do, and this is where you click, and this is why we do it. Because, and people have tried as well, but because they're not, I'm not actually sharing forests or whatever you call them with people. Because I'm not actually sharing them with anybody. You know, I've got my own little way of making sure that what I'm working on's, you know, backed up, and I've always got a fallback and a rollback and stuff like that. And it's not the best way, it's probably quite convoluted for some people, but I'm convinced I need it, but I need someone to show me how to do it.
You need that light bulb moment. There'll be a moment when something will go wrong, or you might even start to use a source control product, and you'll use it blindly and just think, yeah, this is not really giving me any benefit apart from checking in every so often, and then something will break spectacularly and it'll save your skin. Mm-hmm. Really, when that's like, aha, this is why I'm using it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think it's changing your work process as well, the way you doing your commits and everything, your bits and pieces.
I think it kind of encourages you to be better as well. I know it sounds weird, but when you've got to commit something, you feel like it's got to be good.
Yeah,
everyone can see it.
Yeah, like even if you do your own, like I've found it handy before, just on your own personal project where no one else is ever going to share it, but using it kind of as a backing up process and a way to roll back. But it does make you think more about whether this bit's actually done, because you've got this commit button that sounds really formal, more than just, yeah, I'll save that and change it later and come back. Maybe that's just me.
It's like getting married, you committed. Okay, so let's move on to the feature, which this week is on Y.NET MVC.
BugWorld.com. Okay, so this week's feature is based on a blog post I wrote for BugWorld, when was it, last week maybe? Essentially, Paul had asked me to do a bit of a summary and intro to .NET MVC, based on a couple of things really. One was that we'd started using it here. Another was that a new release was coming out and it was kind of being used a lot more. And the final one being, of course, that Cassonified brought out Hello App, which a lot of listeners may have used or seen or heard of. So what this feature is going to be is kind of covering that article, but I'll get Dave to jump in as well to give some contextualized stuff to Headscape, because one of the projects we've been working on, Dave's been doing. So although I'll cover that content, hopefully we'll get some added bonus material here from Dave. So the article itself was kind of like a sequel to one that I wrote about Don't Hate Me for My.NET, which was essentially me whining about the lack of .NET in mainstream kind of conferences, things like FOA, or if it was included kind of as a that thing that nobody likes to do, that thing that nobody wants to do. So that was talking about kind of the preconceptions people had and how you could work around that if you wanted to, how you could use .NET still in a nice kind of way. So this, when this MVC stuff was out, and a lot of people commented on that first blog about the fact that MVC was around and that you could use it, and therefore issues people were having with markup and all kinds of other stuff with .NET weren't necessarily the case anymore. Okay, so .NET MVC was announced quite a while ago now, I think it was 2007, and a full release came out some months after that, and then recently I think is it beta 2, Dave?
We made it to version 1 I think back in January, but they had a number of sort of releases up to that point, but version 2 I think is still in preview stage, although I've started using it and it seems pretty good.
And it's been used on quite a few one of things. I don't know if you guys have used it. Have you guys known the Stack Overflow website?
Nope.
Or not?
Okay. Nope. Carry on.
That's kind of the big example of using MVC. It's a quite a interesting change in paradigm of discussion type page websites. What it's got instead is Q&A. So someone will answer a question and people will post answers and you get a lot of reputation and all kinds of badges and things around. But that's kind of the flagship-ish thing that most people know for MVC. And they're actually doing those Stack Overflow events up in London in October. And I believe they're covering some of that stuff as well as some iPhone things and all kinds of other bits and bobs. It should be good.
One of the key things that people really didn't like about .NET web forms was that there was no real separation between your code and your HTML, and it was so tightly knit together that the code actually made bits of the HTML and stuck in weird IDs and all these nasty things that interfered with stuff on your page, which designers would look at it and think, this is horrible HTML, and there were ways around it, but a lot of people would say the whole point of using a nice framework like Waveforms is that it does a lot of the work for you. So, you know, you take advantage of all the wonderful controls it gives you, and you end up with nasty HTML. One of the fantastic things about MVC is that there's a complete separation of the HTML and all the code behind. What it does is it's just really clever about all the posts it gets, and it doesn't make any presumptions as to what the HTML is that's generated it. So you can happily build your HTML however you like. It's got lots of helpers to generate common bits of HTML like input forms and that sort of stuff, but it's nice, pretty, clean HTML, and you can customize it without any trouble at all. In fact, you can just take your HTML from the designer and just make it work with it. It's that simple. Then you've got your sort of code behind, and the code behind is it translates your URLs into classes and objects and stuff, and you take your actions and you take your what's going on, and it just makes it nice and object orientated.
Okay.
I think we'll switch back now. I think what we've done now is Dave did a bit, and now we're going to go again.
Right.
Okay, so yeah, to elaborate on what Dave was saying there, that people that as designers and people who've not used .NET 4, people who've moved from PHP, would find that there'd be these things called server controls, and what they were assistants for back-end developers to do stuff on the front-end. So if you wanted a repeating list of something, you'd use an ASP repeater, or you'd use a grid view, and those grid views would literally be a tag in the HTML. It wouldn't look like a table tag or a P tag or a div. It would look like an ASP control, and in the code behind, they'd bind to it, and that would just repeat some HTML. It's kind of out of control of the developer and the designer. You could control them through these things called custom control adapters. And what that did is these controls existed as actual classes, and you could override the way they rendered. So you could override the fact that it rendered as a series of tables and TDs and TRs, and you could make it divs or whatever you liked. But that was a bit kind of hardcore. You had to actually register them, and you had to have these really big classes full of different types of rendering and ways it posted back and handled things. Whereas, as Dave was saying earlier, the MVC stuff doesn't really promote that at all. What it promotes is these HTML helpers, which are just small classes with small methods to output little bits of tags. So if a designer came to you with a design and said, this is what I want my screen to look like, these are the markup elements I like, you don't have to turn around and say, okay, but I can only give you a table instead. Can you now restyle it using the table? You can just go, okay, that's fine, and just use that. So that was the markup problem you used to have with WinForms and MVC. The other problem that a lot of people said, and these problems I'm listing here are comments that were put on the post I wrote about .NET Web Forms. So other than markup, people also were concerned that Microsoft were pushing web forms, and they were pushing it because they wanted to assist .NET WinForms developers to get to the web forms world without having to worry about state. So you'd be able to have buttons that had on-click events, and it would act as if it was a Windows program. And the tutorials they gave you, or a lot of the tutorials they gave you, focused on that kind of stuff. So to make it easier for the back-end developer, the focus primarily on the back-end developer. So you'd have a thing, for example, like an ASP SQL data source, and you could just put a tag on the markup and say, this is a SQL data source, this is the database connection string, this is the query I want to run. And it would just populate a grid view that you match that up to. So again, it was kind of this black magic of these server-side controls, far less sort of granular. I mean, there were ways around that, and I wouldn't want to say that all mature was like that, because it wasn't, but there was this, the kind of beginner guides always seem to point to these kind of things. Mm-hmm. Whereas MVC, on the other hand, they seem to be less doing that. I mean, I know Dave's gone through a lot of the tutorials on the site. I've done a few as well, and there's one that I linked to explicitly in the notes here that kind of pushes you to be more, to design more what you're doing. So it enforces, the examples show you layers of services and repositories, or it shows you the separation of controllers and the views, and you're kind of enforcing that view rather than going the easy way, which is what a lot of previous tutorials did. And that leads on to the third point really there about how web forms kind of got annoying people. That was that to do this separation, if you didn't want to go that way and didn't want to use the traditional way, what you had to do is kind of craft it yourself. So, for example, the CMS we use at Headscape is .NET, and it's written in .NET, evolving from an ASP Classic thing way back in the day. But now it's .NET, and what we do for our output is we actually generate XML from our code and then use XSL to transform it into the actual final output. So the designers, if they liked, could work directly on the XSL. The XSL is totally within our control, and we can use different ones for RSS or for normal pages or for any other kind of content we want, JSON, AJAX, anything like that. But we crafted that ourselves. So we had code that would manage that. We had to put code in that would do the rewriting of nice URLs and all that sort of thing. Whereas a lot of that comes kind of for free with the MVC framework. So the equivalent of that, of our XML and XSL, would just be that you'd have an ASPX view, and you'd have your repositories generating code from generating data for the controller, which would then pass it down to the view. And I don't know whether Dave wants to say anything about how he was doing that and how that differs from our current, our old CMS, rather.
Well, the nice thing about it is it's all about the key idea of separation of concerns, where the view doesn't really know anything about where the data's come from. All it knows is it takes this bit of data and it can display it on the web page like this, and that's all it has to worry about. Then it means that your controllers and your models in the back end, all they have to worry about is receiving data and doing something with it, updating your database, sending off an email maybe, then turning it into different types of data and sending it to the view. And the most importantly is that your controller doesn't know anything about HTML, it doesn't know about HTTP code, it doesn't know about any of that stuff. All it knows is how to receive some variables or parameters from the form or from the query string, deal with it and then send back some a data model maybe. And that is really great when it comes down to something like testing, because what you can do is you can test the entire functionality of your site and check that if you send it this data and this data, that you get back a sensible result, like a success is true or whatever, and the application doesn't break. And you can test all of that without hitting web pages. Because before with .NET you have to do these complicated things. If you want to do automated testing, you have something which pretends to be a person hitting buttons on a page, which just seems silly. Whereas this, you can test all your logic and all your code without using web pages. You have a file which just sort of calls a bunch of commands, say, create this type of controller, send it this information, did it come back good? Came back good. We're all good. But yes, it's all about separating all the logic away from the HTML, which is nice.
Yeah, I don't know whether we'll go through the actual how it's separated out, but just one thing that I did add in the article was of how a lot of people kind of dislike Microsoft stuff because they see it as a big, bad, evil enemy, and obviously in some ways it probably is, but people aren't necessarily as aware that there is what you can run these .NET things on Linux servers. You can run it through the Mono project. You can create your source code in Mono Develop, which is an open source IDE as well, which I know Dave's run on his Mac before, and I've run on install of Ubuntu. So you can code to .NET using Mono. You can deploy to Apache and not worry about any kind of licensing costs for Windows servers. If you are interested in that, there is a podcast that I linked to, which I guess will be in the show notes as well, which has got Miguel de Icaza, which is me pronouncing a Mexican guy's name. I'm probably getting it quite wrong. But he speaks on the Stack Overflow podcast about that and about Silverlight and how they're working on open source equivalents, essentially. If people are interested in that, they should take a look at those links.
Okay, great. I have to admit, most of that went over my head completely.
I wonder if it made any sense at all. But we'll see.
It did. As I mentioned earlier, I'm playing with a .NET app at the moment that our guys are building, and that I'm working on the front end. And it seems like the MVC, I've played with some MVC frameworks before, like Rails and CakePHP. And the real beauty and the power comes with the separation. It means that if you're doing stuff purely on the front end, you don't even have to see any of the server-side code like that's sequestered away in the controllers in the model. Mm. We're working on, I think it's web forms or whatever, I'm not quite sure, that I'm having to work with at the moment. And the code is just kind of polluted in a way with all the backend code.
I think we spoke about it, and you were using stuff where it was binding, and there's if you see a lot of angle brackets, ASP colon, that's pretty much web forms.
And the guys I'm working with are quite open to try and improve the markup that's coming to the browser. Before, they were using all the standard controls, and they're just horrendous in regular .NET or web forms.
Yeah. The markup. I mean, there are ways to do it, and like I said, in my previous post, we spoke about other ways you can do it, but it was more like you were working around it rather than it was giving it to you.
So
that's the key thing with MVC.
And I'm using CakePHP at the moment, like on side projects, and it's my first foray into MVC projects. And the real power there comes when you actually start to trust the framework, and instead of like when you're doing front end code and just doing HTML markup, you actually start to trust the terminology probably differs from framework to framework, but the elements and the partials. Where you might use the code to generate a link instead of just writing the raw HTML, but in that the actual framework maintains your relative URL path, so you don't have to, if you change where a file is located, you don't have to go through and change the file paths and anything. The actual framework will take care of things like that for you. Little things like that really, when they all add up, really save you a lot of time in development. And I guess I've not looked into .NET MVC. Yeah, but I guess they're trying to go down the same route as Rails, I guess.
Yes, it's very similar in many ways. You build up root tables which map URLs to a variety of controllers that you've set up.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very similar idea.
Yeah, I mean, the blog post shows like a really mini example of a viewer controller, how the roots are defined in global. So if that's helpful as a comparison to Rails, as I mean, the good thing about the .NET MVC framework, which may well also be the case in Rails or PHP, you have to let me know if it is, is it's extensible. So for example, the view engine that exists by default is the ASPX one. So the web form stuff you've seen, it's kind of like that, but it's using the MVC framework and MVC view data and view models. But you can actually whip that out and replace it with your own. So you can put in an XML XSLT one, you can put in a Spark Engine one, you can put in one that's got totally different kind of syntax and use that instead. So many elements of it are kind of far more pluggable now than they were before. So you can just pick and choose which bits you want and how you want to use it together.
You don't feel like you've been told how to do your work. You feel like you've got control. All it's done is done the bits which are kind of annoying to do, like mapping up custom URLs and stuff, and it's done all that for you.
What are the error messages like? So one of the things specifically about CakePHP that I love is that if you were to feed a URL for something that doesn't exist but you want to build, say if you do whatever.com/blog, it will say, right, you need to create this model, this controller, this view file as a basic thing.
I used CakePHP a while ago. I did like that. That was kind of cool. MVC doesn't do that. That I know of, it's never done that for me. But
I think
the error messages are generally more friendly. I mean, there's been a couple of times where an error message it's not just not really explain the problem, but just explain why something doesn't work. Rather than saying couldn't find this, it says we looked here and there wasn't a file. Maybe you haven't created it yet, or maybe it's in a different folder, something like that, where it actually explains what it didn't find and what you can do to fix it, which is kind of nice. It just makes things a bit easier.
So
I think the thing that makes Microsoft and the .NET MVC framework different from those other ones is you get, it's more of a build a site framework, or it sounds like that for the PHP ones and the Ruby ones, where they, like you say, you put in a URL and it will tell you to make it. What Microsoft seems to be providing is more just a common code base that does do a certain amount of wiring up for you. So your routes will be wired up for you, it will call actions and it will call the controllers and that sort of stuff, but the rest of it is kind of you. They're giving you more a component library and a bit of a framework, whereas the really opinionated ones seem to almost tell you this is how you make it. It's almost guiding you how you make it, which I don't think, whether they're trying to get there or not, that they're not there yet. It's more of a library of code and a very thin skeleton of framework, rather than do this way. Less opinionated, I guess, than some of the stuff you get in other languages.
So how are you finding the learning curve from ASP.NET web forms to MVC? Is it a big jump?
To be honest, I never really did a lot of web forms. A lot of what we do is using XML and XSL, so we had a couple of pages here and there where we use web forms, but I always found it kind of annoying and so never really made the effort in learning it. So MVC just seems kind of natural to me.
Yeah, I mean, I did a job, two jobs before using this, and I built personal stuff with it as well, because it was something I learned. I think the majority of .NET developers seem to be people who had a job doing something else and then got asked to migrate because some kind of management decision decided that Microsoft was going to sound better, and you could get, because with Microsoft you can get kind of like partner status and you can get badges and you can do exams and stuff, which you kind of can do with some PHP things, but in a less obvious big marketing way. So I think a lot of organizations use it as a marketing thing where they can say we're an approved supplier or we're a qualified practitioner and those sort of things. So I started a job as PHP, doing some PHP work, and we migrated to .NET Web Forms. And the biggest thing that I disliked was that feeling of loss of control. So with PHP, whether I was doing it right or wrong, because obviously I probably was doing it wrong, you could literally loop an output, you know, character by character, exactly what you wanted. And when you go into the .NET Web Forms world, where someone says, okay, well, here's a grid view control bound to your query results, you feel less in control. And another thing that with .NET Web Forms was you couldn't even choose your IDs on elements if you did them as server controls.
I hate that.
Which what that meant was when I was developing those, a designer would give you an output with some CSS, and you just couldn't. You'd be going back for almost every element, saying, "Can you change the ID to a class?" And so your back end coding was affecting the front end when it shouldn't. It should totally have been agnostic, and that was what pained me when I was using .NET Web Forms. So actually the move to think about MVC, where Dave's been saying obviously you've got that kind of granular control and you can mess about and do whatever you like, it's taken me back to a step, I guess, to stuff I used to do before, where you felt far more like everything that happened was down to you rather than down to some sort of mystical, magical thing happening. But then, of course, that causes problems, because you'll probably get people who've only learned .NET Web Forms and then they don't really know about HTTP posts and verbs and view state, how to maintain the state between stuff.
Yeah.
They're kind of reliant on the Microsoft way of doing stuff. and they've almost got to learn the web, if that makes any sense. I don't know, because the .NET Web Forms thing was very much like Windows GUI programming. So you could, if you wanted to, for example, use a designer and put a button on, double click on it, and it'd give you a click event, and that would put some JavaScript on the client side, which would call a post back, which would post back an encoded state back to the server, which could then turn it all into variables and properties on classes and objects for you.
Yeah, so the problem I have was, because I came from I did a bit of PHP and classic ASP before .NET, so I knew how the web worked. I knew what an HTTP post was, and I knew how session states worked. But I didn't know how .NET works. So in learning .NET, what I wanted to do was try and figure out how .NET works. I wanted to learn what was in the view state. I wanted to pull it to pieces, which is kind of not really what they wanted you to do.
No.
And so I felt like I was sort of, rather than just accepting that it worked, I wanted to see how it worked and pull it apart.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to say that anyone that did web forms doesn't know what they're doing, but what it did mean is that you could be mastering it if you didn't care enough. So you could use these tutorials, and you could do it in a certain way that you did know the web, and you did do stuff on the net, and you were doing JavaScript, you were touching server-side stuff, you were touching forms and posts and all that sort of stuff, but you were still masked in this layer of abstraction away from the kind of truth, which I think MVC is kind of going back the other way.
Yeah, I've seen I've come across a few kind of .NET developers who do use web forms, and they use it in like a drag and drop programming way. They're not really interested in how it works. They just plug things together and things work, not in the most
that's
elegant
not always
way.
It's not always a bad thing. I mean, there's a time and place for abstraction, and if it helps businesses build web applications quickly for internal use, and people who don't care about web standards, it's not visible to the outside world, they just want their regular WinForms programmer to build them a website, it probably was fantastic, and it probably did give them that power, and that it sort of opened up the possibility of the web to someone who didn't understand it, and that is a good thing.
Yeah.
I get a bit of criticism for that, but not everyone cares about web standards. Web standards is brilliant for the World Wide Web, it's outside, but that's not everything that web pages are used for. I mean, there's lots of applications which aren't visible to the outside world.
No, totally. I mean, it brought in a lot more people that didn't used to do web development into that world. All the people, all the knowledge they had from people who did VB6 and did applications in Access or just directly in VB6 were able to jump to the web without much stopping them, much barrier to entry. But if they stayed there, or if someone just learned that, I think it could cause a problem in general, especially in terms of if you tried to then get a job doing something in another language where you were more exposed to that.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that, of course, there were ways of using web forms, and there still are now, and people are still using web forms. I mean, MVC isn't promoted as a replacement, although you get a lot of blogs talking about it in that kind of way. It's promoted as an alternative to the web forms way. So there are still people doing web forms, as building all kinds of quality applications, but there are those problems for beginners, I think, where it gives you too much, maybe.
I guess the comparison is something along the lines of something like, I've not really used MooTools or Prototype much, but I've seen a prototype. I guess WebForms is a bit like Prototype, where sort of it's kind of a JavaScript framework, but it's not got the flexibility, whereas MVC is something a bit more like jQuery, where you still feel like you're writing JavaScript, but it gives you that layer of abstraction, but it doesn't tell you how to do it. You still have the control of what you want to do. But it's the same idea that people learning jQuery aren't learning JavaScript. They're learning the language, and they're learning how to build really cool stuff, and it's fantastic. But they're probably missing out on all the stuff that we had to learn before jQuery, which is attaching events and binding and unbinding and all the sort of nastiness, the tricks you have to do to get stuff to work in IE 5.5 and all that stuff, which people aren't learning, but then one day we won't need to know anyway. So it's that sort of thing.
I guess a big benefit as well is for any, and like non-developers, but front-end developers, like I know you do a lot of front-end development, Ryan, whereby you could do front-end development for Rails or for any other MVC framework and move across different frameworks, because they all use the same concepts. You'd be familiar with how the views work, even if you're not familiar with the back-end code.
Absolutely,
so
yeah.
You can just jump from different languages to languages. And whereas if you tried to jump into something that wasn't MVC, just a pure code base, then alright, there's a big learning curve there to try and learn what's going on. But if all you're doing is working with the views and the view states and all, building elements and partials, which are small snippets of code that you reuse everywhere.
Absolutely. The easiest back-end developers to work with are the ones that have embraced MVC and just, you know, you're just building you know, the views for what they've already built, and you can just separate and you don't have to worry about anything else. It's certainly the easier way to work. It's the way forward.
Yeah, I just wonder if there'll be a big, if you guys at Headscope are looking into it to move all your development onto MVC. Obviously there's an issue there with the cost in time that it's going to take to pick this up, whereas obviously you could just run with what you know already.
Well, that's kind of like, that's the dream. I mean, moving it all towards an up-to-date framework is that goal, which ever seems to be just too far away. But it's more of a long-term plan. I mean, there's just so much legacy code. There'll be no business sense in doing it. But it's just a process.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't just go, okay, well, all my old projects now, I'll go and redo them all. That would be madness. It would be a partial thing. So, for example, going back to the fact that we have this CMS that we use, you'd be gradually introducing changes, refactoring some of the core stuff, changing some of the front end things, you know, and it would turn into, over a number of iterations, the kind of dream that Dave just described.
And you make sure that any future projects, you're always improving yourself as you ever, you know, there'll be more modern, you know, more recent projects that you've worked on that are MVC that are better coded than projects you did 5 years ago. You know, you're forever improving, you know, your work method. Anyway, so even if you started applying MVC to everything now, in 5 years' time, you'll be doing it a completely different way, looking back at it and going, well, should we rewrite everything? Nah, it's going to cost us a fortune. We'll just improve our current workflow. So
yeah, I think we're going to look for something like what Carsonify did, a small app that maybe isn't mission critical and no tight deadline, and something that we can take the time and
something
learn.
Where it's nice and simple, something small, because if you think, well, I've got this big project coming up, let's use MVC, you end up trying to solve complicated problems in an unfamiliar environment.
Yeah.
What you really want to do is solve something really, really simple with something new. So, like Hello App, we downloaded it, look around, there's what, a couple of controllers, a couple of routes. It's nothing really crazily complicated, so you can sort of look at it and go, oh, so that's how you did it. And it wasn't a difficult idea, so it's definitely the way to jump in there and start playing around with it.
Yeah, I mean, I always think developers should kind of have a few little mini side projects on the go as well. So even if you can't do it at work, maybe look into implementing in something minor for yourself. I mean, my own website was written in a kind of XML XSL way using normal .NET, and I'm migrating that to MVC, not just because I love coding on the weekend, but because it gives me that opportunity to try something out, and it doesn't matter if it breaks or fails, because it's not, you know, you haven't got someone down your, you know, behind you saying, come on, we've got a deadline next week. You can just try things out and play with them. It kind of goes back to that first article where we were talking about different things you can try out.
Yeah.
Even if you build it and throw it away, I mean, there's nothing wrong with building something and throwing it away. That's quite fine. Because you learn, it's all about learning.
Absolutely. It's, I think if you work in this industry, a lot of people who work in this industry, it's also a hobby as well, isn't it? It's kind of a lifestyle choice working in this industry. You're always keeping up with things.
Yeah, a lot of people I meet, especially at events and stuff, then of course it's not just a job, it is a hobby or a lifestyle, as you put it. But then you come across a lot of people in industry and they are just like, oh, well, it works. Not bothered about learning new stuff, and it's half and half, really. I think if you're like listening to this podcast and stuff, then I guess most people are the kind of people that will happily sit on an evening and tinker with new stuff, and it's to be encouraged, really. It's how you learn and how you're going to improve your skills.
One of the big things about getting a couple of projects here at Headscape to use MVC was that the entire battle, in fact, wasn't it, the entire battle was convincing the different people that it was a good idea. And it's a trick that it's something I'm still pretty bad at, and I'm trying to get better, but it's something that Paul Berg has been trying to explain to me, is selling things to different people in different ways and really slowly. And it's about finding out what someone is going to get excited about, and then sort of getting them really excited about that one little thing. I mean, there's so much about the MVC project framework that I find is fascinating and really clever, but it's about picking something which someone is going to be interested in and think, wow, yes, that really is very cool, and selling that part of it to them. So for someone, one person it might be the separation. So if you're selling it to the designer, you think it's a separation of concern, a separation of the view from everything else. If it's
a project manager, it'd be something like maybe saying the testing framework, how, you know, the project's going to be more reliable because we can build up test harnesses and we can be more sure that when we rebuild it, a small change isn't going to break something. To another person, it might be, it's just easier. I mean, it's just, it's going to be quicker to develop. You know, you'll be less time banging your head on the table and more time just in the pub. So it's about finding something they're going to get excited about. And
it's kind of becoming like an internal salesman, isn't it, really?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay then. Well, that's really good long feature. We've talked for ages on that.
So it started pretty well, though. I thought the beginning was the best bit of that feature.
And then it just turns a rant.
Well, you see, around about 25 minutes in, when I joined in with a sentence, I think that was the best bit, personally. So let's move on to the listeners' questions. Okay, so the listeners section, we have a couple of developer-centric questions here, and the first one is managing your code, and it's been sent in by a chap called Jamie, and Jamie writes, I recently started developing my own system for building web applications. I found that as projects have ticked by, I've ended up with a large assortment of code of different versions and functionality. How do the back-end development guys at Headscape manage this code mountain beyond the project-by-project SVN style management? Go on then, guys. They're asking you specifically, and here you are.
It's exciting, isn't it? Okay, well Headscape has a strong design consultancy background. However, the development side of things has always been done internally since the beginning. In fact, the design tech teams are of equivalent size, and we have a large number of legacy and concurrently running projects at any one time. So therefore, source control and code management is pretty vital. As a team, we rely on kind of three main methods of this transfer of knowledge, both between team members, over projects, and over time. And this includes the standard kind of code committing stuff, a source control system, and an internal wiki that we use for snippets, interesting decisions, rationales, any kind of product roadmap, that kind of information that's longer and wouldn't fit in code comments and is good as a reference if someone's about to join a project or if it's been passed to someone else or that kind of thing. So as many of you are aware, and as I spoke about earlier, we have an in-house CMS, and this acts as our base for our common code and contains multiple projects. One of them is a common code repository, which is code that is generic across anything, so we could reuse for a web project, or we could reuse for an application, a Silverlight client-side thing, anything like that, common classes that we've used as a layer on top of the .NET classes that you get for free. The other projects there are the CMS class library project, which is CMS specific stuff. So although we've got a common code library for generalizable code, like extensions to collections or special ways of sorting or whatever else, we've also got a library that is the classes just for the CMS. So that's saving documents, workflow, those kind of things. And then we've got a base web project, which is the actual website. So the web files, the JavaScript, the CSS. So those three main files are part of this CMS project in our source control repository. And when we get a new project in, we'll take a base copy of that from a stable label version of that CMS, take that into a new project in the same repository, set that up so it runs on our local development server, and use that for all the development. So any changes and check-ins happen to that from a base of an initial check-in. So you know that if you look at the history of that project, that's everything custom for that project from the source base as the label was taken, and that obviously will be document in the wiki when that was taken and any kind of associated information with that. Then of course what you can do is as the development progresses, you can generalize certain pieces of code from that project and pass that across up into the base CMS project. And normally what we do for that is we'll have a review with at least one of the developers who wasn't working on that project so that they can check for quality and they can see if it is something that is generalizable to put into that common code. And that will actually then be sort of manually put into the CMS base project. We don't kind of branch it because obviously a lot of our projects can be very specific. So it may be that you do a project that, although it was based on our CMS code, actually was just wildly different and there's nothing directly that you put straight back into the common CMS code. So we'll do a review, we'll put that back in, and then the next project after that's been tested and stuff, the next project will use that as a base to begin from, and then you'll progress like that in a kind of staggered, we'll do a number of different projects that could be happening concurrently, find some generalizable functionality, put that back into the common code, and then use that as a base for the next one. And in that way, you're kind of doing this thing we talked about earlier, how we were saying partial and slow improvements rather than like a big wholesale change. So I can't envisage a time when we sit down and say, okay, we're going to spend the next couple of months making a whole new project where this old code is now totally out of date and this new code is brand new. Let's start from this. you've got this incremental change where on a per project basis, where you're obviously getting paid for the work you're doing, you're able to get that code and then put that back into your common like code for later use.
I think a couple of things. I mean, firstly, it's a matter of organising it really, really well. I mean, if you've got your code spread over like, lots of different files, and all these files are kind of tied together, then you're going to not be so inclined to delete one of those files because it might be used by something else. So the trick is firstly to make sure that your code is nicely organised, so you've got, say, a class file or something which has a particular job, and you know that this file, this class or this file, it does this, and it does it all by itself. And then organise it nicely into folders, that way you can find things. Also, when you if something is no longer being used and you've got a source control system, don't be afraid to delete it. I mean, you've got a backup of it, it's stored somewhere else, so don't clutter up your project with a bunch of files which aren't being used anymore, because the next person who comes along isn't going to think, oh, I wonder if this is done before. What they'll do is they'll just write it from scratch themselves and think, I can do this better. So if it's an old file, it's probably not going to be used, delete it, just get rid of it, and keep your code nice and concise and clean. Don't be afraid to throw it away.
Yeah, I mean, the good thing there comes with the wiki, of course, is what you can do is if you're working on a project, you can say, okay, well, I need to do, I don't know, postcode lookups, for example, some sort of task. You can go into the wiki and do a search on some keywords for that, like postcode or lookup or whatever, and get some pages where someone's written about how they implemented it for a particular project, what pitfalls they had, what issues they encountered, how they worked out, and then, of course, what project it was. So then you can go from that initial search through the wiki, read whether it's relevant to you, and then go to the actual source control database itself and find the particular files and classes. And, of course, another thing about, just to echo what Dave was saying there about having small classes, the smaller you can make these snippets, if you like, these functions, these classes, include files, whatever it is you're doing, the easier it is to manage it, because you've got less versions per thing. So if you've got 20 classes in one file, you might have a history in your source control system that's got like 500 changes. But if you've actually split that down into a whole series of smaller classes, smaller files, not only is it nice and an OO and maintainable, but also your check-ins are specific to the individual task you were doing. So you've modified one particular thing. You haven't modified a massive, amazing God class. You've modified this very small, unique class that was what you needed to update or add to.
I remember when before I started coding in classes and stuff like that, and just did procedural coding, and they were all in functions and stuff like that. I remember having a file called mfod, which was mega function of doom. So mfod.php, and that just did everything.
Or you've just got an include classes or include functions.
Yeah,
and it's just like, yep, yeah, there it is. Yeah.
Just include mfod, and that'll just do everything for me. Things have improved a little bit since then. That was a long time ago.
Exactly. It's totally down to your code design as well.
Yeah.
So the way you manage and break down your projects into your modules, your packages, your classes, whatever, is going to make your organization of files a lot easier. Like you say, if you had a big file just called functions, you're going to have a hell of a job knowing that you've got 50 different versions where you modified it slightly for one project, modified it slightly for another project, added some extra stuff for this project, fixed a patch in the other project, and just go on forever.
Yeah, I guess you've got to make the code as generic as possible as well. If you think you're going to get it reused on other projects, you maybe don't rely on a specific subset of data that's got to come in. You make it generic and then just extend it for a particular project only.
I think totally, yeah. I mean, that's a question you've got to ask yourself after each thing you write. Because I think as well, if you do have a common code library that is not meant to, in our case, for example, we've got a common library that's not even meant to be CMS specific. That makes you think each time you add some functionality, hang on, is this actually just, I want to have a nice wrapper way of generating random numbers in a particular manner. Okay, well, I can make this in a nice, very clean, separate little way, and then I'll call that from my code rather than putting it directly on your code for a page.
Yeah.
So I think by having that organization set up before you start, you're immediately thinking in that way. So you're thinking, well, this actually belongs in the common XML code library. This belongs in my CMS library. This is so specific. This is using a login system of this particular university, therefore it's just in the project code place.
That'd be a benefit of code reviews as well, won't it, for someone else to say, well, why don't you abstract that out into a separate class and keep it separate, having another set of eyeballs. Well, I know for me it makes me a bit more, I guess paranoid's the wrong word, but it also, if I know someone else is going to look at it, I think, oh, let's make it good.
Yeah, that's a problem I have with being on my own. I'm quite methodical about making everything as clean, just because I've got obsessive compulsive about stuff like that. But occasionally when, you know, deadlines creeping up, it's like, well, no one will see it.
I guess you could jump on Twitter and stick some code into Pasty or GitHub Gists and send it out, and if you know lots of people are going to see it, then again it's going to make you focus on it a bit better. Just because you're in your own at your desk, and I mean, I know you're not on your own, but there's plenty of people out there that you can speak to and get feedback on things.
Yeah, occasionally.
That's one of the things about writing things like JavaScript, because it's programming, but it's right out there, and everything you write is visible to the wide world, unless you obfuscate it, whatever. I had that weird experience about a couple of weeks ago, so I made a little app called ChromaTweet, where it's basically showing tweets in various colours. But bizarrely, about a week later, I was looking at the stats, and there'd been a bunch of links from I can't remember the name, it was a jQuery demonstration site, and someone had found my site, taken all the code out of it, all the JavaScript, and put it right there on display on their own website. And it was also properly attributed, but it was weird seeing all the code I'd written, like, between 11 and 2 in the morning, and sort of hacked together and sort of minimal comment, suddenly up there on display, and people look at it thinking, oh wow, this is a jQuery sort of example of how to use it. It was, yeah, it's kind of made me think of it.
Notice the excuses there. No, it's between 11 and 2. Just in case you looked at it and it's not that good, I was tired, I was slightly hungover. You've got to love that. Everyone does that. If you ever see code, it's like, yeah, I wasn't really paying much attention at the time. It's,
yeah, just ignore that bit. Ignore that bit. I know that's terrible.
It works. It's fine.
I'm actually...
Oh yes, Karen.
I was going to say, I'm actually writing some code at the moment that I intend to release publicly for free, which is probably the first time I've ever done it, but it's taken me so long, cause I'm so paranoid about the code that is good. I want it to work perfectly. It's taken me ages.
I did a tutorial for .NET that came out this month, and I've never gone over my HTML, my CSS, and my jQuery. So, you know, every single line, right, does that need to be there? Does that need to be there? Is that the neatest way of formatting it? You know, just because it was going to be in print, and like, oh my God, right, and checking through it and saying, right, I've changed all this. I better make sure it still works now. And then actually...
I'm still working an article for Paul for Biogrid, which... I'd sort of take it as a bit from our CMS. I've taken out a bit and thought, well, we don't need that bit of HTML, and that bit I can take out, and I've got to make this perfect because I've got to make sense and it's got to still work, and it's all going to be different but perfect, and it's, yeah, I'm just never going to finish it, I don't think.
I think you've just got to kind of take it for granted that someone somewhere is going to find something bad and tell you, and it shouldn't put you off. You just accept, yeah. Someone's going to spend the time analysing everything I've wrote here and slate the whole thing.
It's like them people when you say, oh, I've launched a new site, and someone goes to it and goes, it don't validate, and it's like, piss off.
Oh, that irritates me so much.
Yeah,
I mean, see that.
It's like someone knows where, the W3C validator is. We'll go to this, it don't validate, you're shit. It's like, piss off.
Yeah. We had that argument recently in our team, because the big site I've been working on, the CSS doesn't validate simply because it's got a lot of CSS3 selectors in there.
Mm.
And they're the only things that don't validate, but still, CSS don't validate. Yeah, so.
But who really cares? The browser likes it, so.
Hang on, you don't care about web standards?
No, there's a difference between web standards and validation. Web standards. Let's not even go down that road, Greg. Let's just not even go there. I mean.
No, yeah, I think people like to think. I don't want to slack it off now, but I think there's a small minority of people, let's put it that way, that like to be able to say something about what you've done.
Have an opinion.
And the easiest way is to do those kind of simple quick checks, which, to be fair, I guess you could argue you should kind of just fix, and it's kind of your fault for letting something through, but yeah, there is that element that you get. Yeah. Tase, I guess.
It depends what's failing as well, doesn't it? It shows if they complain about something, it just shows a lack of understanding on their part, really, which just makes you go, ha, I am smarter than you.
Just to go back briefly on the code thing and quality and stuff, one of the things that Headscape kind of do now is have the developers all together. You know how we were saying how if you show someone your code, you're more inclined to make it better?
Yeah.
One of the things, before I joined, I think, actually, the whole company used to be quite separate. So you had designers working on their own, you had the developers that were there either coming in less often or working from home as well. And one of the things they did was bring together the development teams. So we're pretty much in together every day. And that gives you that ability to just ask someone quickly, and also to have people occasionally look over your shoulder and ask what you're doing. And I think that probably just encourages a bit more quality as well. Maybe not.
Okay, so we've got one more question, and it's on friendly URLs. And this chap called Daniel Farrell writes, my university has ridiculous URL naming scheme. For example, this is how to buy Photoshop. Oh, God. Right, read the show notes, because he's wrote out a whole massive long URL, which I particularly like, because /personal computer support and mobile services /, that's one big long word, okay. So it's rubbish. I can see what they are trying to achieve, human readable and logical ordering of pages, but by nesting on such a microscopic scale, they produce the opposite result. The pages are no longer memorable and not even easy to read, because you need a huge screen wide screen to see the whole URL. Huge screen wide screen to see the whole URL. You need a big screen, basically. Furthermore, because software is a service provided by the ICT department, it must be nested underneath it. This reflects the management structure of the department, not necessarily the way a user thinks. For example, why couldn't the URL be /software shop /Adobe? What are your thoughts on human readable URLs, and how would you tackle the problem of making such a huge site easy to use? Should I have more sympathy for the web team, or do they need a good kick up the ass?
Right, well, there are a number of reasons that large organisations use long and often convoluted URL schemes, and one possibility is that maybe they have different parts hosted in different places, and it does funny things behind the scenes, and there's a very good technical reason. But it may even be that they've got different systems running under different subsections, so you might have like a shop system which sits underneath a couple of other levels, and that shop generates its own URLs. I'm making excuses for them, of course, but I don't really know how it works. But you often get that if, for example, on Boagworld, the forum sits under /forums, then you get all the forum URLs after that, and it's not that bad, but you can see how these are things scale up to become quite big. But firstly, gonna sound controversial, it doesn't always matter. I don't know how everyone else uses the internet, but I often go to Google, search, once you start navigating around, it's... I'm just clicking on links. It doesn't matter how big the links are. I mean, there are times when it does matter if you've got a big URL, but these times are when you either have to remember it, and, I don't know, you're watching TV and they flash up an advert and it says you've got to remember this URL, because if you don't go to it later, you'll be missing out on something massive. Or there's a post as another example, or, you know, sharing your friends. But often there's a trend you can see, particularly, I think there's one for Channel 4, where, or was it one of Channel 4's subsites, maybe 4 something, they're saying, rather than giving a URL at all, they're just saying, search for this online. And they're expecting people to forget a URL, because people do, but they expect people to maybe just remember a couple of keywords, which is a lot more likely. And maybe it goes to some hideous URL, but Google has indexed it for these keywords, and if you search for it, you'll find it. So, and of course, you know, the other example when you need a short URL is things like Twitter, or sort of sharing links on Facebook, whatever. But there are URLs, shortening services like Bitly, TinyURL, which will do this for you. So, you know, if you want a short URL for this site, what you do is you just shorten it yourself and bookmark that, and there you go, you've got your own short URL, you can create your own name for it. But, yeah, the only times when it is necessary is when it's something you've got to remember. But a good example of a massive site which does do this really well is the BBC site. And often they'll have, like, I don't know, a show like The Apprentice, and they'll say, you know, go online, bbc.co.uk/apprentice. And if you type in The Apprentice or The Apprentice or whatever, there's a couple of variations, but they will get there. And you think, if the BBC can manage it, I mean, they've got this massive site with all these different sub-sites and TV shows and radio and iPlayer and that, and they have managed it, and I guess they've just got a huge amount which is directly under the root, and they sort of, it makes sense, and people can find it. But then, a lot of time, if you organise a site well enough, it's not that difficult to find. But, it wouldn't be so difficult, I guess, for the university to set up something like a shortcut where they go to, if you go to name of the university /software shop/Adobe, it probably would find it, and maybe it redirects, and that wouldn't be so difficult to set up. But I imagine it's just the university being a little bit lazy and not seeing the benefits, to be honest. I guess once you start navigating, the URL gets built up a bit, and, you know, you might do a filter or a sort, that sort of stuff, and you might want to organise it by price, and you find this one, so you sort it by, you know, you get a bigger URL, and that just happens. And to be honest, once you start using the site, it doesn't really matter a huge amount.
I think anything past, you know, two steps people aren't ever going to remember anyway, you know. And I've sometimes gone to a site where, you know, you want in the about information, so you'll do /about, and, you know, if it's set up well, you'll get there. You know, I regularly now, I don't go to the Apple site, I'll go to store.apple.com/UK to get to the UK store, and I've learned that kind of short URL to get to the store on Apple. Like it says here, you know, softwareshop.com/Adobe, like you've just said, Dave, that's kind of memorable, and I think if anything past that, you're fighting a losing battle, really, because no one's going to remember.
And there's also one of the projects I were involved with recently was a university course finder, and I had to put a hell of a lot of effort into the URLs, even though they ended up quite long, but simply because they'd probably be used in print. So there's the main domain /course finder, and then a load of different situations, like different parameters that can be passed, but they all had to be quite nice and neat. So it might be /Faculty of Engineering, or /2009-10 Faculty of Engineering for the year, or you could put in a letter keyword in there, so it might be /M/term/course name or something like that, but just simply because no one would ever really search manually for it, but at the end, if they went through a journey, then they've got a nice neat URL that they can paste somewhere or put in print brochures and things. But it's a lot of work.
Was that mega htaccess file you sent me?
Yeah.
That went on for like days. It was like scrolling down that thing.
No, well, there were about between 8 and 10 different htaccess rules. I did manage to rationalise it quite a bit, but there were different. So, like I say, it might have been /course ID/course title, or it might be /faculty name/course ID/course title, depending on how they wanted to structure it. And then the search parameters, like a query string or an A to Z letter, or the term, because you can search for different terms in the same courses. So it took quite a bit of headspace, but linking to specific pages is fairly easy to do. But when an organisation like a university or the BBC, they've got hundreds and thousands, if not millions of pages, they're not going to set up a friendly URL for each one. It's just an impossible task. And like Dave said earlier about The Apprentice, yeah, the shows have got their own, but the pages within the shows won't. You'll go to Apprentice, and then you might get a longer URL after that. So it's the time and effort spent to maintain all these links, especially for something like university, where it's not often centralised. The faculties and schools and departments are their own kind of authority, and they can chop and change pages at will. So are they responsible for managing the human readable or friendly side of it, or is it a central web team that has got to be notified when pages change or get deleted and then modify the URLs? It's not as simple as it first seems.
I guess the trouble is that the example is the university URL they got here, is that the URL is probably reflective of how they've organised their information hierarchically, which probably makes a lot of sense, but the trouble is the user doesn't always think like that. The user thinks, well, I just want the software shop. So they don't think, well, the software shop is probably part of the software purchase site. They don't think like that. But obviously, if you're generating these URLs based on how your information is organised, that's how it's going to be. But I guess there's little things they could do. I mean, for example, personal computer support and mobile services doesn't have to be one long word. I mean, they could have just said support. I mean, that they could have picked a word, which, or they could have even abbreviated to PCS or something, I don't know. Because people don't care that it's personal computer support and mobile services. I mean, they're not going to type that in, and if they look at it in the URL, it doesn't really matter. So I guess there's little things they could do, like just shorten some of the longer words.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like that's just auto-generated from the title of one of the sections.
Yeah.
I just wrote a title for one of the pages, which was personal computer support and mobile services, and it just went, you know, the CMS they're using just went, okay, that's your section for your nav. Yeah, I mean, you've just got to define, I guess, if you can, again, depending on the size of your site, those entry points. As you say with The Apprentice, it's the entry point that's actually the interesting, the one you need to do.
Yeah.
The one that people might actually try and hack in by typing it in at the end.
So you might put in, say, software, that would make sense, or shop.
Yeah, or software shop. So it's the one that you think people might want to guess. And, of course, there's not actually that many people that probably will type in the URL bar.
It's true.
I think as developers, we're kind of like, yeah, people will be writing in the bar, they'll be hacking the URL. It's like there's not many that many power users that are like, hang on, I'm going to guess this.
As well, with big organisations, I know you guys at Headscape work with higher education a lot, and when you get down to the faculty and department level, they're often used in their own content management systems that are all different, and they will come with their own system for doing URLs, so they're never going to be consistent. It's a pain.
It boils down to how many people are going to care. I know I feel better when it's a smaller URL, but I know that's just purely an aesthetics thing, and it doesn't actually matter to me browsing the site. I mean, it matters to me that I can see it, but I get over it, you know, life goes on. I don't really lose sleep over visiting a site with a long URL. So.
This has given me an idea, actually, maybe a Friday afternoon project, but an institutional link shortening service. Instead of, because I know we've seen print materials that have tiny URLs on them, but we've got a fairly short top-level domain anyway, so maybe a Friday boring afternoon project will be to build a service.
I think people
it's
also
a bit of a fad at the moment to have everyone have their own URL shortening service. So a few sites have got their own domain specifically for shortening, which I guess is just.
It only really works if people know they exist. Otherwise, like, I want to send a link to Ryan's article. Oh, I'll just use, like, tinyURL or Bitly.
Yeah.
They're not going to know that Ryan's spent weeks and weeks, like, crafting this beautiful system that sits on some other domain that no one knows exists.
That's where canonical links come in, Greg, and where, you know, you can mark up your HTML with what the canonical version is, but anyway.
Yeah, but the majority of the use of tinyURL and Bitly is people who put a link into something like TweetDeck or some other thing, and that does the shortening for them just by something that's affiliated to that particular tool. So if I put a link to your blog in TweetDeck, it's going to shorten it using tinyURL or one of those other ones. It's not going to go, oh, I better go and hunt down. I mean, it might do in the future, but is it even worth it anyway? I don't know. What's the real benefit? I guess you control it, but I don't know.
I think the thing with tinyURL and things like that is the URLs, you know, yeah, it shortens it down so that it'll fit into a tweet, but it's completely meaningless half the time unless you've specified, you know, something at the end of it, you know, that's meaningful. But a lot of time, you know, you just get one of the auto-generated ones which people use, and they just say, oh, found this, and it's just gibberish anyway. You wouldn't print that, or you wouldn't send that off anywhere, would you, really?
Well, you might do, especially if you're a big organisation, and you've got maybe systems that don't give you anywhere near friendly URLs, and you've got big, long strings, that if you're going to put that in the printed material, you're not going to expect the person to type it out on the other end. So a tinyURL or something can be really handy in printed material, and maybe an institutional way of doing that instead of having tinyURL.com.
They're all case sensitive, aren't they? And there's nothing more annoying than having to type in a URL that's case sensitive.
Yeah,
and there's also no guarantee it will stay there forever.
No.
True.
I think it's important as well for IT departments, web teams and stuff like that to realise that it's okay to put, you know, example.com/services and then right at the end and click on this product.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And just say, you know, go to /services and click on Adobe. You know, people will read that and it's like, oh, that's a reasonable instruction. Although services/Adobe is fine, but, you know, as an example, it's okay to just have a short URL that takes you through to the top level area and then tell people where to go.
It's all about the entry point, isn't it?
And if you, you know, like you said earlier, if your site's structured properly, then you don't even have to explain to people where to go. They should just know when they hit your site.
Yeah.
So, okay. I think that was a pretty exhaustive answer.
I've rant on for hours about this kind of stuff.
Okay, so that's it. We've come to the end of the show. Shall I tell my joke?
Go on, then.
It's a slightly sexist joke.
Yay.
Slightly.
Well, it's a blonde joke. Do you think I'll get in trouble for telling a blonde joke on Borgworld?
Although
I swear that Marcus said some kind of blonde sexist type joke last week. Anyway, three women on a desert island, and they're completely on their own. One's a redhead, one's a brunette, one's a blonde. And they want to get over to the closest island, which is 100 miles away. And they say, right, we're going to swim this. You know, redhead decides she's going to have first go, so she starts swimming towards this other island, which has got people on and shops and everything. You know, they want to get back to civilization. And she sets off swimming. She gets 25 miles out, gets tired and drowns. So the brunette thinks, well, I'm going to have a go. You know, I'm going to try and get to this island. And she sets off swimming, and she gets 50 miles and gets tired and drowns. And the blonde says, well, you know, they've gone. I'm all on my own now. I've got nothing to lose. I'll go. So she sets off swimming. She gets 75 miles, gets tired, and swims back. Yeah. That lost on people.
I think by the joke was that long that I'd forgotten how far away the island was.
I was just looking around the room.
Completely zoned out.
Do you know what? I now feel for Marcus on you know how badly his jokes are received, and I'm never going to tell another joke again. I've been saving that one all week since we had the show with Marcus last week. I'm just like, I'll tell that joke next week.
So it's fine. We can edit in laughter. Should we do that?
Yeah,
we all laugh now. Then,
yeah, after three.
See, if Anna just cuts down the time gap where we all just sat in silence, so that you end the joke and then we all start laughing.
Go on then. It'll be perfect. Laugh now then.
No, don't do it, Anna. Well, we already did laugh when we figured out that we couldn't understand the joke.
that was the funniest bit of the joke.
All right, there you go.
Okay then, so that has been a developer-centric episode of Boag World, as requested by our listeners. So whether or not it was any good is up to you. Leave a comment, let us know.
Yeah, vote for Paul Marcus's panel on the South by Southwest panel picker.
Absolutely, and we'll speak to you soon. See you later.
Bye.
See you later.
Yeah. Hello, world of Boag.
Like being on David Letterman.
Boag World! Boag World!